Welcome to our Open Research Podcast. We invite you to join us in our audio space here at Sheffield Hallam University to dive into more in-depth discussions around open research. I'm Domi Smithson from the Library Research Support Team, and today, for the very first episode, I have invited Dr. Keith Files, Research Development Manager for Policy and Performance, to talk about the purpose of open research and why do we advocate to be as open as possible at every stage of the research project. Hello, Keith.
Hi, Domi.
Could you tell us, what is open research?
Okay, so I think open research is really the principles and practices to make research processes transparent and collaborative. And then particularly it's to have scholarly communication that exists outside of publishers' paywalls. There's quite a long tradition of it. It's something that really sort of started coming to the fore in the late 90s, early 2000s, with the rise of the internet, really. The idea that people wanted free online access to journals, where they'd been paper-based before, so you had to pay for the copies of them, that the internet enabled them to be free. And so this should maybe be a thing. I think there's probably a bit of tradition before that time with computing and physics was pioneering it. But it was really the rise of the internet that brought it in. Mm-hmm. And it was really useful because it was a big sort of disruptor, and it helped people start thinking beyond the idea of publishing being a commercial enterprise only and needing those sort of private sector publishers. So there's a bit of a tradition with this. So scientific publishing is massive, big business. I think it has annual revenues of £20 billion a year across the world. And the model's quite interesting. So in a lot of publishing, say for magazines, for example, you'd need to pay a writer, pay an editor, pay for your distribution, all that. And those type of magazines have sort of quite small profit margins, maybe 10%, something like that. Whereas traditional scientific publishers, they have fewer of those costs. So the writers, our researchers are funded by the government. The bulk of the editorial work is done by volunteer peer reviewers. And then the distribution is free on the internet as well. So they don't have the costs. So then because of that, their profit margins are enormous. They're usually sort of 40 or 50%. And that's being paid for by university libraries. So it's this model we call double dipping, that as universities we're paying for the research, paying for the researchers, or even triple dipping, because we're paying for the peer reviewers and their time and their work, and then we're buying the things back again. So this model's kind of been broken for quite a long time. It's been a bit of a bad deal for researchers and definitely a bad use of taxpayers' money. There's a bit of a sort of history behind this, the way that academic publishing came together. There was a guy called Robert Maxwell, who's quite well known. He was the editor of The Mirror, and he was involved in a big sort of pensions theft scandal and stuff like that. But sort of post-war 40s and 50s, he just kind of caught on to this idea that academic publishing had the massive audience but no costs. So he just went around buying up all the small independent amateur titles, and the company he set up, it was a company called Pergolum Press, that went around and it bought up probably about 1,000 of these amateur titles and established this new model. That company sort of ran for 30 or 40 years and sort of was eventually sold to Elsevier. So we get this model of these big kind of corporate entities. There's now sort of four of them, these sort of mega publishing houses. We've got OPU, Elsevier, Springer Nature and Taylor Francis, and all of them own thousands of smaller titles. So like I say, it was just this sort of unsatisfactory solution that sort of enormous profits are being created, and it wasn't really serving academia or the taxpayer well. So that was sort of the motivation for a lot of the work in the open research space. And then since it sort of technology first made it possible 20, 25 years ago, there's slowly been sort of things coming through different organisations. Lots of it driven in Europe, but in the UK, sort of probably the key one was around 2013. That Hefke, who have become Research England now, proposed a policy that after Ref 2014, all articles should be made accessible in institutional repositories after they've been accepted. That was the proposal. There was a bit of sort of fight back against it. And in the end, that policy ended up not being introduced until April 2016. And again, there was a few concessions around embargo periods. So for STEM publications, there was a 12-month embargo period. For social sciences, arts and humanities, it was 24 months. But that was the first thing in the UK that really sort of drove it, that the Hefke policy, the REF policy. But that's always been a transitional arrangement. And a lot of stuff that's going now is, can we get rid of those embargo periods? Can we do anything else in that space? So that's sort of been the history and sort of journey of it so far.
So why do we want to practice open research? What is the benefit behind open research?
There's lots of things. So you probably want to split it between the benefit to the individual researchers and then the benefits to society in general. So
that was my idea. So okay, let's start with the microstructure.
Yeah, okay. So for the academics, I think first of all, it just gives them a greater audience, that you publish something and it's closed, then no one can read it other than the few people that know where it is. But you publish it open, and then anyone that's got an interest in it in the world can discover it. It's easy for you to share, just to forward on links and say, what do you think? Publish it sort of in blogs and in social media. Just bring that attention to it. So in that way, it gains more traction, more people read it. It also brings it open to more criticism, sort of in the neutral sense of the word criticism, which is a good...
constructive criticism.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It sort of stimulates... Mm-hmm. Debates, it evolves thinking, people might pick up on things you'd not notice, so it helps you refine your thinking for next time round. It also opens up to more collaboration, so there might be someone on the other side of the world that reads your thing, that gets in touch and say, oh, this is really interesting, I'm doing something quite similar, do you want to get together, should we work on this?
Or actually not something similar, they can pick it up and come up with some new ideas on how to approach those research findings that the original author didn't really think about. So it opens up an alternative way of how to approach that research as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And then the other thing is, in terms of who's reading it, so there might be other collaborators, other researchers, but it's also people outside of academia. So it might be a group, we would call them a user group or a beneficiary group, that might read it, that again wouldn't necessarily find it in a closed academic publication, but it could be sort of, if you're looking at a treatment for something, it could be a patient group that might discover it and sort of get in touch with you and can apply your research and use it. And again, it's that kind of pathway to impact that opens up.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing it's really good at is just creating much greater diversity in research. So mm-hmm. rather than having sort of small, close communities, it opens up to people from cross disciplines, different parts of the world. It's just feeding into that pool of understanding, which it does lots of things. It stops people making the same mistake. So it could be things like publishing null results, so people don't bother trying that again. Or they could try and replicate your results and find it doesn't work, and find there's actually another factor or condition that hasn't been taken. So it just kind of advances human knowledge and human understanding in lots of different ways. And also just breaking down that barrier between the academy and the public as well. It just sort of opens everything up.
I think it's also about the speed, isn't it? It's about the rapid publication process.
So instead of having stuff hidden behind an embargo for 2 years, it makes it available. And especially sort of we saw things like during COVID, how rapidly sort of a lot of things were needed to be shared then, so people could build on findings, creating vaccines, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That kind of the move to sort of preprints were quite significant there. Just getting things out quickly, just to move on the speed that others can build on your work.
Which traditional publishing process was basically proven to be too slow.
Yeah.
So it did really demonstrate the power of preprints and sharing knowledge.
Yeah.
But that also, that rapid publication is driving a faster impact as well, doesn't it?
No, definitely. So amongst those people that are picking up research much quicker and more broadly is the what we'd call research users or research beneficiaries. So it could be if you've published something about a specific condition, that patient group around that condition might much more readily pick up your research, implement your findings and create sort of real benefit of it. That transfer of knowledge to outside of academia happens much more effectively and can create real kind of outcomes of research rather than just outputs.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned knowledge transfer. So in terms of that, can we also add international accessibility into that bucket?
Yeah. Because that's one thing with sort of making stuff open on the internet, that it's available to anyone with a a computer connection, with probably most of the world now.
Which is then really assuring a greater opportunity for discovery.
Absolutely.
And then on the other hand, it's also helping to decrease duplication of research, I would say, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes you do want to duplicate things because you want to replicate them, and that's a good thing. But yeah, sometimes you don't want to do what's already been done. You want to build on those findings. So just having that access at the touch of your fingers to sort of everything that's gone before lets you kind of position your questions to be cutting edge and to be able to take on that intellectual debate a bit further.
Having that research disseminated is also a really good content for meta scientists.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a whole kind of area of research in its own sort of systematic reviews and similar things in other disciplines as well.
What kind of economic benefits do we have from open research?
A couple of things. So a lot of it, kind of going back to what I was saying at the beginning, that a lot of money was leaking out of the public sector and universities into these enormous corporate enterprises. And actually, it's about sort of reclaiming some of that, especially at times when across the world public finances are quite stretched. It's actually being much more efficient. There was an old tradition of university presses where you'd kind of publish your own things. And obviously, they need safeguards to make sure that they are rigorous, so things like external peer reviewers and that. But yeah, it's just about sort of shifting things back a little bit in-house, lowering costs. If we're sort of making it available ourselves, then we're not paying the subscription costs, all those kind of things. So there's economic advantages. So that's why a lot of this has been supported by national governments across the world, as well as universities. But then sort of specifically, there's incentives to do this, so referrals make sure that we can only submit stuff that's been made open access, so that's being used as a lever to make sure individuals and universities comply. And it's the same with funding from UKRI agencies, that they're usually with stipulations that things have to be made open access. So it's this kind of government using these levers to create better sort of value for universities and for the taxpayers.
But also another benefit would be that there is a lower cost of creating and reusing data.
Yeah.
If we follow open research practices.
Yeah. No, we've not sort of spoke much about data so far, but that's a whole massive area. So sharing your findings is one thing, because that helps sort of move on intellectual thought. But sharing your data is where huge efficiencies can come, because you've collected your data, used it for one purpose. But then if you put it in a repository, sort of obviously with all the precautions around the anonymization of participants and whatever, but then someone else can reuse that data set for a different purpose. And there's just real sort of efficiencies with that. People can combine multiple data sets from across the world and have findings that really on that kind of much, much bigger level as well. So open data is another massive area that fits under the open research agenda as well. It's perhaps a bit less developed than publications, and sort of publications, you have the levers of things like REF and UKRI funding that say this must be done, whereas with data, it's always you should make this available. So perhaps that's the next thing that's coming along, that there might be more sort of levers to get sort of wider application of that.
In a way, you can say that you're indirectly contributing to the further research.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a resource that you're making available to other researchers across the world for the good of research. And
so it's like the Olympics in a way, open research, where you're passing on the baton.
Someone else
can join the race.
Yeah, absolutely. And you still get credited for it, because people will reference your data as well.
And then what about the public disclosure and engagement? How do we open up research to the public and with the public?
So some of it we've mentioned, sort of the direct beneficiaries, the people who are the user groups that have particular interest in it. But a lot of it's also just about breaking down the barriers between the academy and the public. So sort of bringing in greater trust, greater scrutiny, involving them in sort of contributing to research, more sort of citizen science, things like that. There's just lots of ways we that sort of making research more open and transparent increases that discourse with people that aren't in research, and it brings sort of greater understanding, greater trust in it.
Mm-hmm. Because it's about the active participation in scientific experiments, but also in data collection.
Yeah, absolutely. Citizen science is a thing that there's all kinds of. It's got quite a long tradition. This, like, people have been doing sort of amateur, I don't know, weather observations or something like that, and created massive data resources. So it's just something like that you can, if there is public that are interested in an area, you can kind of almost outsource some of your data collection to them, and just bring in that extra resource.
And then last but not least is that the public can access your findings. So as you mentioned before, it's also about the policymakers, decision makers, budget holders, about the public sector. It's about ordinary people. It's about families, patients, parents.
Yeah, all of them. Research can be used by lots of people. Like you say, there's different things. There's direct beneficiaries, sort of got a specific condition and I'm interested in it, I can read about it. But yeah, it's that policymakers as well. It's bringing all that information so people in governments and councils can make sort of evidence-led decision making.
So what initiatives related to open research are there at Sheffield Hallam?
So there's a few things. So a lot of this we frame under something called an open research statement. It's the SHU open research statement, which is something I think we put together about late 2019, early 2020. And this was just responding to external developments in this space, but actually kind of codifying it into an institutional policy where we set out our expectations in this area, but also sort of, and then probably more importantly, we signpost guidance and support and infrastructure that we have here. So that kind of frames the three different areas. So it's open access publications, research data management, and responsible use of metrics. So we have this kind of policy framework in there, but then there's also the practical support, sort of especially along from the library teams, where they can sort of help with compliance with REF and UKRI rules, so making your manuscripts available, some of the systems like the data repository, lots of support and guidance around that. And then we also have an open research champions network where people that have sort of passion in this area and want to be advocates can sort of join, chat with equivalents in other departments and help sort of support their fellow sort of researchers kind of get to grips with this agenda and be sort of implementing good practice in it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the talk, Keith.
Thank you.